Welcome, and thank you for standing by. All participants will be in listen-only mode until the question and answer session of today's conference. At that time, you may press star one. Today's conference is being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect at this time. I'd now like to turn the meeting over to Irene Qualters. You may begin.
Thank you. Good afternoon, everyone, and thanks for coming. It's really my pleasure to welcome Tiziana Di Matteo from Carnegie Mellon University. And she's going to give a talk on the next frontiers of massive galaxies and quasars at the cosmic dawn. But I think she may also talk a little bit about the recent frontiers that she and her team have been exploring with the Blue Tides project and some of the work that they did on Blue Waters. And this is another case where the availability of observational data combined with simulations that haven't really been possible before are really increasing our fundamental understanding of cosmology and origin of the universe. So with that, I should give actually a little bit more on Tiziana's background. She's a professor in the McWilliams Center for Cosmology of the Physics Department at Carnegie Mellon, and she received her PhD in 1998 at Cambridge University in the UK. And she was a Chandra Fellow at Harvard prior to coming to Carnegie Mellon, and a junior faculty member at the Max Planck Institute for Astrophysics in Germany, so a very international experience as well. She is received the 2008 Award for Excellence from the Carnegie Science Center, a recipient of the Pittsburgh Foundation Fellowship, and a fellow of the American Physical Society as of 2014. Well, welcome, Tiziana. Thanks for coming.
Thank you, Irene. Thank you, Irene, for the introduction and for having me here. Do I need to speak at this microphone, or I do, so I have to stand here? Okay. Okay. Just remind me if I'm moving off too much. Okay. So, yeah, I'm excited to tell you a little bit about my research and in particular some of the computational work that we've been doing with Blue Waters. And so what we do, we just produce universes on a computer. So I'll tell you a bit about that and what we learn from them. Okay, so I'm talking about what we call cosmic dawn. So what we mean with that and what I focus on today is how does structure start forming in the universe. So this is a very brief, sketchy way just to sort of place ourselves in our universe somewhere. So we have a big bang on this side 13.7 billion years ago. Something happens after the Big Bang. The universe expands really very fast. We have the cosmic microwave background production. This is the first time photons actually get freed up from the rest of the matter and travel to us. And the universe at that point, although this diagram is still very small, very compact, and the matter in the universe has been imprinted some fluctuations like we see in the cosmic microwave background. We know directly about that. So there's some matter in the universe, but there are some fluctuation in density in this matter. And after the universe is cooled off enough, these density fluctuations are growing more and more under the action of gravity. Eventually, they become large enough that the first objects in the highest density regions of the universe start forming, the first galaxies, the first black holes. So we have an epoch in which the universe is still pretty neutral. We have these densities that are growing, but they haven't yet formed any of the structures that we know about today, any galaxies. We call this the Dark Ages. So after the Dark Ages, we start forming the very first galaxies, and this is what I want to focus on. This is roughly between 300 million years, 800 million years after the Big Bang. So what are these objects? What do the first galaxies and black holes look like? And what do our theories tell us about them? And how do we simulate the formation of these very first structures in the universe? Okay, then the history of the universe continues for a long time, and we form the universe that we see today, the rich hierarchy of the very structural galaxies like the Milky Way and many very large galaxies and black holes and so on. But for today, I'm going to concentrate at this first production of galaxies in our universe, okay? So the very first objects that are forming. So why is it fun to go there? Because observations are starting to probe this epoch too, okay? So I'm going to start sort of setting the landscape, telling you very briefly what do we know about these very early epochs of the universe. So although the majority of what we know, it comes from the Hubble Space Telescope that has imaged the sky, okay, in very, very small patches of the sky. It's looked very hard for a very, very long time in tiny, tiny patches of the sky. So by staring hard enough, by going deep enough, we are getting the light from earlier and earlier on in the universe. And this is what the picture of that tiny piece of sky that the Hubble Space Telescope has been staring at for a long time look like. Most of these objects are galaxies. They're galaxies in the foreground, so they're actually galaxies closer to us, like spiral galaxies, things like that. But you look deeply enough in these images, and that's what the Hubble Space Telescope has been doing, it's been able to probe by looking in this field at epochs that are close to roughly a billion years at first. And this is the kind of galaxies that it's seen when the universe was roughly a billion years old. So galaxies are starting to look a bit different from what we have images of the Milky Way. They're kind of elongated, interesting morphologies. But it's gone even deeper to the absolute frontier in observations of what we've been able to see. This is about between 400 million to 700 million years after the Big Bang. And this is the highest redshift galaxies that we know about. This smudgy blobs, red blobs that we see, okay? So these are actual galaxies that are seen in the sky. And so in these images, there would be tiny little points that you see in the background there. They're sort of very red. The light has been redshifted a lot to get to us. And they're very, very tiny, okay? But these are actual measured galaxies. So what is the problem here is that we see as a snapshot in this very tiny region, these very, very compact, smudgy galaxies at these very early epochs of the universe, 500 to 700 million years. This thing looks very different to this. This is a galaxy of today, the universe today, okay? So it's much more compact and much less structured, okay? So this is a galaxy that is very nearby. This is the furthest away galaxy that we know about. So Hubble Legacy Ultra Deep Fields tell us that they show us very compact, very clumpy, irregular morphologies of galaxies in the very early epoch. So what you'd like to ask, is that it? Is the universe just filled up of these smudgy little galaxies? And these are the very first galaxies that form in the universe. Are they really what they look like? So we can ask ourselves this question, have we seen anything? Everything that there is to see, and it's going to be just what we would expect these first galaxies to be. So just let me take you into some kind of comparison to the very local universe now, okay? So this is a projection of all the galaxies that we know now very close to us. This is the Sloan Digital Sky Survey. This is a very large survey that has imaged practically most of the sky, most of the nearby universe, and this is what the structure, so every single point here that it kind of indicates the position of a galaxy, which is well resolved, okay? So we know that the universe has these filamentary structures, the galaxies are brought together, clustering together in these filaments by gravity and so on, and we know about the probability of each one of these galaxies. So this is a very large scale picture of the universe, but very local, very close to us. So if I was to compare the size now of the Hubble Deep Field, how much of the universe would I have seen compared to the Sloan Digital Sky Survey that has imaged the sky today, this is how big it would be. the full volume that we've seen of the higher redshift universe corresponds to a tiny, tiny fraction of what we know today. What we say that there's a huge cosmic variance associated with these observations. Obviously, to go as deep as it does, Hubble, it needs to do it in a very, very tiny beam. And but that tells us that it hasn't actually seen much of what's out there, okay, even compared to the redshift today. Okay, so what I'm saying is and I'm going to give you these units that I'm going to keep using. I'm going to use a measure of distance as parsecs, as a measure of length. This is about 3 light years, okay, where a light year is the time taken to the light to travel to us. We're going to be using cosmologically mega and giga of parsecs. Okay, so just to imagine, a few hundred parsec away from us is the nearby stars, okay? So this is sort of the distances that, on average, the stars that you see in the sky, they would be hundreds of parsec away. Okay, but we're talking here of much bigger scales of the universe. Okay, so in the very high redshift universe, we've only seen a small fraction of what's out there. And in fact, if I just carry this analogy further, and I say, what if I only knew about tiny patches of that sky in the universe today, instead of having this beautiful image in the background, if I only had image small sizes such that Hubble would feel, I would know about galaxies in volumes like this, that I extract randomly from this much bigger volume. So I could have easily imaged a very, very high density field of galaxies or a very, very low density field of galaxies. So whatever the Hubble Space Telescope is telling me is pretty much very cosmic variance dominated. It's a random realization of a tiny region in the universe just because it's so small. Okay, so it's a fun place then to go and explore. What is all the rest of the stuff that's out there in the early universe? Is it just what we've seen or not? Then there's another fun thing that we know about the very early universe. So besides this smudgy galaxies, very, very tiny, we know about a giant black hole at the very edge of the universe at the epochs that we can probe. This is at redshift 7, and sorry, I'm going to keep switching to this astronomy units from time to time. So this is still the same epochs, about 400 million years after the Big Bang. That's what I mean with Z equals 7. And this is not seen by Hubble. This was found serendipitously in other very large surveys. It's so bright that the light from this very massive black hole, that material going around this massive black hole, allows us to infer that at this super early epoch, while we have these tiny smudgy galaxies, we have black holes that are already as massive as the most massive black holes that we know in the universe today, 30 billion years after that object there. So another big puzzle about the universe, how could we possibly have such supermassive, the most massive black holes sort of present there, or at least one of them, but even one, what does it indicate? Is there some special physics that is different to the way we understand black holes are growing and forming in the universe today? What is it signaling to us? So this is the other puzzle, okay? So compared to, again, the Sloan Digital Sky Survey, most of the sky image today, all the galaxies, in all of this volume, we're saying there is one object, a high redshift, in a volume comparable to this, that is a supermassive black hole. Very rare, but supermassive. So I'm gonna kind of take these two example problems to see how we can tackle these sort of questions from a theory point of view, from this work that we do with the simulations, okay? So how do we expect such a three massive black holes to form? And what do we expect the galaxies to look like? Talking about black holes, what do we expect to happen in order to have these black holes? Today in the universe, we see black holes virtually in every galaxy that we observe, that we are able to make as a measurement. Okay, so black holes live at the center of galaxies. In the early universe, we think that these black holes must have been seeded by some event. In the very early galaxies, that, that could have been that gas is so dense in the early universe that, that it can collapse directly into a black hole, or there could be some other event such as the formation of the very first stars that are likely to be extremely massive, 100 times that of the mass of the sun or so, can very quickly evolve into the formation of a black hole. So supposing we do have this seeding of black holes in the very early universe, it's still not enough. These black holes will never be a billion times the mass of the sun, such as the one that we I talked to you about. So what we need to do to these black holes is to grow them. How do black holes grow? Mostly by just swallowing gas from the surrounding material. In the galaxy, there's a lot of gas making stars. A lot of this gas will be also falling into the potential of the black hole and increasing its mass. This is the most efficient way to increase the mass of a black hole, in fact, because it can grow exponentially by swallowing gas. But even if you go through this argument and without really going, there's not much there, but it's a very simple argument. You could say, how much does gas can I stuff into a black hole before this gas itself radiates enough energy that it stops itself from falling in? So radiation pressure and gravity sort of get balanced by each other. Well, I can feed it at a maximum rate and see how long would it take to grow this seed mass black hole into the black hole that I observe at the early epoch. And what constraints do I get? I get that this black hole, from the moment it was seeded by some process to the moment we see it at this very, very early time, 400 million years, it must have been swallowing gas like crazy at its maximum rate possible. So the question is this at all feasible? Are there conditions, places in the universe where this can happen at all? Or when we see these supermassive black holes so early on, they're actually indicating some totally different physics that is not the standard way we think of black holes today and how they grow. Okay, so lots of room for predictions and discovery at this early redshift, at this early universe. Okay, just a very brief point. We know plenty of very small, tiny, smudgy galaxies that in this Hubble legacy field that probe tiny, tiny volume of the universe. Do we have the full pictures of what the first galaxies look like? We don't know. We know about one supermassive black hole at this very early time, and we know that there's a lot of surveys that are going to come online very soon. For instance, WFIRST, this is an interesting I'm sure most of you maybe have heard about it. It's a Hubble Space Telescope, but much bigger, right, that was pointing the wrong way for a long time, right, and then was pointing towards Earth and nobody knew about its existence. And suddenly it was not going to be used that way anymore, and David Spergel and others at Princeton are refurbishing it to actually do some really fun science with it. So this is going to come online, and the perspective that and the future for this is that it's going to make this high redshift universe suddenly accessible in very large volumes. So we are going to know about millions of galaxies where we now know a few tens, and about hundreds of thousands of black holes where we now have one. So it's fun for a place to go and make predictions for. This is going to come in the next 7 to 10 years, okay, come online. And there's lots of stuff, including JWST, that is going to be probing this early epoch. But no predictions, okay? So that was a fun place that I thought we should go into. Okay, so that's what I'm going to concentrate on today. So what are the galaxies like? What do we expect to form in the first 600 million years? Just as we approach the first formation of objects, and what are these massive black holes like? So the only way for us to really tackle these problems is to use very large-scale simulations, and that's what I usually do when I don't have to apply for NSF grants all the time. No, okay, so that's what we do for fun and not. And so how do we start this problem? In principle, it's a really nice problem to be working with in physics because it's a problem that has specified initial conditions these days, okay? The cosmic microwave background tells us exactly what the initial conditions are for this problem, okay? It tells us exactly what the density fluctuations are in the early universe, how much of each kind of energy component we have in the early universe to a very high level of precision. So fun, right? In principle, we have a specified initial condition that kind of looks like that, okay? This is a temperature map for the CMB, but all the information is there. The power spectrum, we have the theory of gravity. We know how to amplify, how gravity will amplify these initial fluctuations. And sort of for quite a while in the field, we've only just done gravity. So starting from a fairly uniform universe that has imprinted exactly these fluctuations that we see in the sky in the CMB, we switch on gravity in a box that is as big as we can, okay? We put it this density field, we switch on gravity, and that's sort of qualitatively what you would say, or in this case quantitatively, although we do that to higher precision. The scales of this box can be large as your computer can fit it in, okay? So for a long time, simulations have evolved the initial density fluctuations just in the dark matter. Dark matter is the major matter component of the universe, and so as far as what we know, it interacts just gravitationally. So we have dark matter, we have gravity, we know how to form these large-scale structures of the universe. These are gigaparsec scale. These are really the universe at a large scale. Each tiny little point would be a very massive galaxy in there. And this has taught us so much. It's taught us to explain, for instance, that large-scale structure you saw in the Sloan Digital Sky Survey, why galaxies are all aligned in this filament, what we call the cosmic web. And we can push this much further. But in the recent years, it's become possible to do much more sophisticated calculations, where we are not only following the evolution of the dark matter in the universe as we move forward in time on the way to today, but on top of that, we can place the gas that is present in the universe. We know exactly how much there is from our initial conditions. And as this galaxy cools in the deepest potential well, it will form stars and therefore galaxies. It will feed in black holes that are present in there. Okay, so this is just a visualization of these different fields. So here we just have dark matter, and I'm always projecting it obviously in 2D, so it's a slice of these cubes. Now we see the temperature of the gas, so we do full hydrodynamics, so we have conservation of energy, angular momentum, and so on, and temperatures and densities of the gas, and we are zooming in at the same time. So the other thing this is sort of emphasizing is the large dynamic range that we want to have in this simulation. We have gas metallicity, stars go supernova, enrich the gas by metals, and we can produce stars directly, right, in here too. So this is where we go and finally go to the scales, way, way down in scale from the original where we see the structural galaxies. And even within galaxies, so the luminous part of the galaxy, we can set the structure inside there and all the way to the center into the black hole. So zooming back out, again, this is an example, again, of seeing the gas density in a slice of these volumes that we simulate and moving out to sort of give you some sense of all the dynamic range from the stellar light to the galaxy that is very concentrated in the highest density regions, which we simulate directly, to the much, much larger scales, all the way to the cosmological scales where we see the large-scale filaments, okay? So we're here again, different fields, this is gas velocity, we're still zooming back out in scales, and finally back to the dark matter density. And this is just a slice, anyway, of not the full volume of the simulation. So that's what we are doing. We're doing this large dynamic range simulations that include not just the dynamics of dark matter and gravity, therefore, but also the full hydrodynamics of the other components of the universe, such as the gas and the stars and black holes, and follow all the forces associated with that over this range of scales. So this is some simulations that we run recently. This was on Kraken before Blue Tides. This is still the largest volume simulation that was done. This is still a very early epoch. You see in the background is the volume sort of unwrapped, and the universe is still much more uniform. But as we zoom into this different scales, and this is the scales that are directly resolved by the simulations, we see these higher density regions, and eventually, and the color coding represents the temperature of the gas and eventually all the way into the inner regions where we have a galaxy. And these spikes will represent black holes that form. And obviously there's no very good way of representing a black hole that shines. So it's just this funny spikes that you see from time to time in these projections. After that, we moved on to simulations that evolve the universe all the way to the present day. So that's how we validate these models. We have lots of observations like the Sloan that I showed you. And we can evolve the simulation all the way to redshift zero, but in smaller volume. And this has also been done in the context of other teams very recently. These are all last year's results, okay? The Lustre simulation by a team at Harvard and MIT and at Eagle, very similar to this massive black two simulation that we ran about the same time just before these came out. And again, what all these different colors are representing is the overall density of the gas color-coded by temperature in some cases. We see even in here the different scales at which we probe it, the large-scale dark matter all the way to the galaxy size scales and even different galaxy morphologies. So this field has sort of exploded over the last few years. The level of sophistication has become much, much better than what we've been able to do until now. Today I want to concentrate mostly on talking about yet a new run, and I'll justify why we wanted to do this in a second. And this is the blue tide simulation. This is currently the largest kind of full physics cosmological simulation that has been run, and but it's been run only to study sort of the early universe formation because it's still too big even for blue water. So just to give you a sense of perspective of what's happened in this field, so when I'm talking about these very large simulations, cosmological simulations, I'm looking at now simulations that include all these different components of the physics, sort of I broadly call full physics, so they produce realistic galaxies with a stellar contribution directly, so they'd be compared to an observed galaxy, all the dark matter substructure in there. We are talking about number of resolution elements that are approaching the trillion, for instance, in this most recent one that we've done, the largest one currently on blue waters. So we are today in the billion to trillion, so this is a function of year, so obviously this field started a long time ago with very simple simulations down here, and obviously, this is all a way of showing Moore's law, that how the algorithms have kept up with the growth of computational power. And if we turn this into the mass of the resolution element now, the function of year, the simulations that we're doing today, so again, these blue water simulations and similar ones that I just shown you examples of, are able now to study the full structure, range of structures over the mass function that we know about. Okay, so the early simulations could only resolve structures at that mass resolution that are as big as the biggest clusters of galaxies that we know today. Now we are at the point where we are able to resolve all the way down to what we call dwarf galaxies, the smallest galaxies, at some level, even within these very large cosmological volumes. Okay, so it's a big change in the field and a very exciting time to doing this work. So I've been asked by quite a few of you, and obviously it's a fair thing, how do we validate these calculations? And I'm not going to talk too much about that today. I'm going to talk mostly about pushing them to use them as prediction tool. But we have a lot of validation with a lot of observations, properties of galaxies that we observe, like from the surveys we know about, and how the cosmic star formation history evolves, and how do we reproduce that or not, how the stellar mass function, how galaxies are distributed with different stellar masses in the universe from direct observational constraints. Okay, so that's, we run these calculations, we produce populations of galaxies and black holes, and we analyze them and go and plot the same things that observers do and compare with direct observations. And I'll just flash you at this the idea of how we validate them, and not going to discuss it too much. But I'm going to go back to the second problem just to illustrate this better. So how do we, what does this simulation tell us then for the formation of this very, very massive object, high redshift? Okay, so I told you a little bit about, we think there's probably a black hole seed that forms in the early galaxies. This is not something we resolved directly, but people study this in very small volume accumulations, okay? So regional very high gas density, suppose we put a seed in there based on some of this knowledge, can we follow now the gas that falls into black holes and grows it? So we can do that in this kind of very large simulation, so we can now go and ask ourselves in this huge volume that we see in the background there, where are the places where I find the most massive black holes? And this is what this plot was highlighting. So I'm zooming in, I'm asking myself, where do I find the most massive black hole? I find it there, which is zooming in these high density regions where there's a lot of collapse, a lot of gas flowing in to this very central object and powering this very massive black hole. And in fact, we can go and measure the mass of this black hole. This is plotted as a function of redshift. So this is early universe, and the universe is getting older, going this way. Okay, so this is roughly the 700 million years mark, and we produce black holes of 10 to the 9 solar masses, so a billion solar masses. These lines here illustrate the growth history in the simulation. So it's just a few examples, and the color-coded, the color area is the ensemble of histories for the, all of the black holes that go to this mass. So what does it tell you? Yeah, our standard picture of cosmology, of structure formation, our standard lambda CDM universe has, once we probe large enough volumes of the universe, as regions that are capable of inducing this extreme growth at very, very early time. And because we have these very large volumes, we can count these objects and say, are they as numerous as the one we see? So this is a prediction for what the quasar luminosity function. So how many quasar massive black holes at that luminosity will we produce as a function of luminosity of the black hole, as a function of the mass of the black hole? So the points here in red are observations. There's roughly one per gigaparsec. And these lines are the predictions. So there's definitely the right number of objects. So it's kind of interesting. So we don't only just overproduce them, but we produce them roughly in the right number. And of course, we predict a large population of other black holes that were seeding and growing in smaller halos that should be detected at smaller luminosity once that becomes possible. Okay, so that's nice. It seems. And I'm going to elaborate a little bit more about this. So obviously we can then go and quantitatively say what induces this very fast growth in this object. And it turns out that this gas can, in this very early universe, is really able to stream, fall into the very central object very, very fast. The gas is so cold, very low angular momentum. It makes these streams that are able to penetrate all the way inside the galaxy, all the way into the black hole, and fuel it at a very, very fast rate, much faster, in fact, than what it can produce stars with. So this is just sort of indicating that this is the black hole mass for a number of objects as plotted as a proxy for the galaxy mass in this very early universe. And these tracks are black holes inside galaxies growing. And as you can see, they grow pretty much vertically. So the black hole mass overshoots sort of the galaxy growth. So black holes kind of grow really, really fast at this early epoch compared to the galaxy that surrounds them. Okay, so they're eventually, when we follow these objects, they will move this way. So the galaxy kind of catches up as time goes on, but the black holes can be fed at a much higher rate. Okay, so this is up to some observations that we already know. Then what was happening, though, is that simulations, that volume was still insufficient to really make predictions for things that are going to be observable in the future, in the near future. So after validating, after seeing a number of promising results, we moved into this much larger calculation. And I don't want to go through this argument too much. Anything that we have available that right now has probes the volume of the universe that is either too small or a too coarse resolution in order to make predictions for this very, the objects that are even earlier and yet to be observed. So going back to this kind of analogy to the redshift today, if I was comparing it to the high redshift, the volume between redshift 8 to 12, these early epochs of the universe, current simulation would only probe a tiny, tiny fraction of the volume, not much bigger than the Hubble Deep Field, okay? The volume of the simulation is just a factor of 2 to 3 bigger cubed. So this is why we decided, okay, let's run an even bigger simulation, and the motivation for this is definitely the science, but also other things too. So I'm going to tell you a little bit more about what we find in this very large volume simulation, and I haven't explained to you what all these bits are, and I'm going to go into it in a second, okay? So this is still projections and images of the simulation at different scales in some regions. But let me tell you briefly a little bit about the simulation. So the blue tides, as we called it, was run on blue water, using pretty much the whole machine in order to do that. So our goal was indeed to try and make predictions for the high redshift universe, the very first epoch of the formation of the first objects, but obviously also stands there as an important technology pathfinder for all the future of this field. You know, we are expanding and making universes that are bigger and bigger, closer and closer to what the actual universe looks like, but also at higher and higher resolution, so we can include physics at all these different scales that we need to include down to close to a black hole. We want that a lot right now, as we are also in the epoch. We are looking forward to even larger survey data like LSST, and we are involved into these kind of collaborations where, you know, the kind of predictions and the kind of mock observations that you can extract from this kind of simulation will be crucial to guiding the kind of science that we want to do with the surveys. So, yeah, we have fun with it now, making a lot of predictions for things that we don't see, but also for pushing this technology so that it's up to the task when we have these even larger surveys and we want to ask deeper questions or more precise questions to our data, or new questions, in fact. Okay, so what is the volume? Maybe it doesn't say this too much to you. It's close to a gigaparsec, okay, in those astronomical units. The resolution is in a volume that is a gigaparsec. It's a few hundred parsec, okay, so I dropped the giga there, right? So so this is the volume on the side like that. So this is sort of the dynamic range. So this kind of scale, we resolve scales well inside galaxies. That's what it means while we do a very large, chunky piece of the universe, very, very massive. So this amounts to about 0.7 trillion particles for this simulation, 0.7 resolution elements. And we have all the sort of sophisticated modeling for the physics that I haven't shown you any equations for that, but it includes all the star formation, the black hole growth, and associated phenomena. So this simulation ends up being 50 times bigger in volume for the kind of resolution that the maximum resolution that we can currently achieve, the maximum amount of physics that we can put in. So you don't just obviously do take a code off the shelf and run it on blue water. Irene would not let you. No, but okay. But you, the code needed to be stepped up to a totally different level. So these are codes that have been developed in cosmology, such as Gadget, for instance, that has been a very fundamental tool in this field for a long time, but it needed to be very significantly rewritten in many parts. So as we move to these kind of scales, we have 81,000 MPI ranks for 8 OpenMP threads per rank. So everything is not just parallelized, but it's threaded. So it's this hybrid parallelization scheme that you can't avoid doing in this kind of scale of calculations. So very, very aggressive, efficient parallelism that you need to implement to run at scale at the full blue water scale. What you get out is a lot of spin-offs and open source contributions as well. We have to dump data in a very dynamic way, so hierarchical snapshot format in the form of new ways of what we call big file, a new sorting algorithm, some large FFT distributed, large-scale FFT pencil beam distributed product to do the long-range forces. Okay, so this is sort of the improvements that we had, which is in the wall time per step, every time step had to be this improvement amounted to roughly a factor of between 8 and 10 improvement in time steps, in making our time steps shorter and shorter. A lot of these words that I'm quoting here have to do with the short-range gravitational interaction, the long-range gravitational interaction. This is how we decompose the domain through a tree and other ways that we need to analyze the data in by putting galaxies and so on, the friends of friends algorithm. So these are sort of area-specific things, but the bottom line is very aggressive rewriting of very significant chunks of the code. So this is an example of the long range force calculation, how we move from doing Fourier transform in slabs into pencil beam to effectively use the resource for the kind of huge slabs of FST that we have to do for this kind of calculations, and a very significant speed up if you just rethink things a little bit. And again, some open source code available for this kind of cosmological calculations that we released. Besides all this technology that I went through very briefly, and I can, there's many other aspects of the code as well that were improved. We also wanted to put in the kind of physics that is absolutely crucial for making some sort of meaningful predictions for these early epochs. So, as I said, the physics includes full hydrodynamics. We have gas that follows the dark matter as it's much less dominant, so it follows through the rotational interaction, interacts gravitational, but also it cools, it makes stars, the stars go supernova. The gas can be in different phases, and it's very important to follow these at these high redshifts. There could be a lot of H2, lots of molecular gas. We have also black holes that emit energy from their surrounding regions and therefore heat the gas that is trying to come in, and all of that we call feedback. So heating processes due to physical sources like supernova and black holes themselves. Also, this is an epoch, again, where the universe is just, overall, the universe is being ionized. The hydrogen is moving from neutral to ionized, so we want to follow that process in some way in the simulation. Okay, so let me then just move on and tell you a little bit more what we see in there. Okay, so let's go back to what are the galaxies like. Okay, so I claim we've done a much bigger volume. Okay, so this is the field of view, if I again project in 2D, of my blue tight simulation. Every single point in here is a resolved galaxy that I have in the blue tight simulation, and this is how big, if I patch together all the Hubble observations, this is how big a volume I would see of the universe. And now suddenly I have 200,000 galaxies instead of 210s, and I can play, I can see what they look like, okay? So this is just zooming in some of these objects and just illustrate what they look like, but I'll tell you a little bit more, okay? So this is now we have a volume to play in the universe, make prediction that is 400 times bigger than the Hubble Deep Field. What do we see? Okay, sorry, okay, not yet. At first, how do we validate this is even relevant? We often plot, even at this very high ratio, there are measurements of the global star formation rate. So you count up all the stars that are observed in those volumes, and you just divide by the volume, and you could do that at different redshifts where there are observations. And what that helps you, there's obviously very big error bars, right? This is, again, very, very early epoch, so these observations are still sketchy and small volumes, so large error bars on this point. But obviously, you aim for your simulation to go through to that point to some extent, right? Obviously, you don't want to overshoot or under-reproduce the star formation, okay? So a little validation first. And then you want to take that simulation and actually analyze like a piece of Hubble data, okay? So this is the very large projection of all, every single point is a galaxy. Now I'm going to go and use Observer's tool, like F-Extract, a tool that looks into this projected field in the sky and finds galaxies, like an observer would do in its own Hubble field. So I do the same, and I ask these tools to find the galaxies because I have direct galaxies in here with a luminosity, with a number of stars and so on. And that's what you do. You go and find either every galaxy like an observer would do. And like an observer would do, we start, again, a little bit of validation and more predictions, but plot the number of galaxies as a function of their magnitude. Another very annoying astronomical unit, it's magnitudes, okay? So the more negative, the brighter the galaxy, okay? So these are, again, number, just what the observers are doing as a as a function of their luminosity. So these are points, the black and green points are the current observations. And again, the blue line and shaded area is the prediction from the simulation. So it agrees pretty well. We were very happy about that. And of course, that helps you with believing what you're going to say about the rest a little bit, at least. So here we go. So the model does agree. So when we extract all these galaxies, count them up, bin them up, just as the observer do, they reproduce the right number at all the way to redshift 10, basically 400 million years, all the way to where we have data. But what I want to really peek at now, this is the stuff that I told you, is all these imaginary little galaxies. But now you see this pale of what I said, going that way, you go to bright. So there's tons of predictions of very bright galaxies in there that could not be observed in this tiny volume. So what are they like? So this is concentrating then on this side of the diagram, what we are hoping to probe in the upcoming observations. These are the kind of objects that are in there. If I plot their star formation rate, how many stars they're making per year, there are about 100 to 1,000. So this is much more than galaxies today. And what stellar masses do they have, these objects, in this very mass bright end? They have stellar masses that are 10 to the 10 solar masses. So these are close to a Milky Way, but at 13 billion years ago, in terms of mass, okay? So they're very massive, but much more compact, with much, much higher star formation rate. They're making far more stars. Then what do they look like? And these are the projected stellar density. So this is face on, this is edge on. These look actually better than those smudgy things. These very massive objects are actually very disky. They are truly much more like the Milky Way, shrunk down in size very, very significantly. Okay, so this is the galaxies, sorry, the stars. This is their star formation rate. This is something that you observe directly, so the UV flux produced by that star directly simulated there as well, because we want to make predictions for what, you know, things like JWST are seeing. But the point is, yeah, so if we go to and look in this much bigger volume, we predict to see much better ordered objects, things that are much disky. And we can quantify this, okay? We can do some dynamical decomposition, say, what is the fraction of very disky galaxies as a function of their stellar mass, as a function of galaxy size at these epochs? In fact, pretty much 70 to 80% are going to be very disky for the very massive end. Okay, so that's going back to this illustration. This is what I was speaking out. So in the background is the full volume unwrapped to the simulation. This is the gas density in blue. That I'm then zooming into some scale, we start seeing some structure. Everything is relatively smooth. It's very early, but as you zoom in, you start seeing these filaments. And this is one region where we, in fact, find a lot of these galaxies as an illustration. This is at this high, early epoch is a very high density region, is a very filamentary structure for this. And these galaxies are kind of collapsing in the process of, right? So they're coming together. And when we go down into this high density regions is where, and these are all the different fields we directly simulate in the simulation, we see the stars arranged in this very disk-like morphology. Okay, so from very large scales, we look for this disk, they do end up in this. You can make predictions if this is, for how many galaxies will it be seen for example, WFIRST, and there should be thousands of these objects if this pans out. This doesn't mean that all the galaxies are disky, even in the simulations. Obviously, we want to go and compare what are the morphology like in the more in the objects that are already probed. Okay, so this is an example of the simulation predictions. These are the observations of these smudgy galaxies from the current Hubble Deep Field. We do indeed have very disturbed and irregular morphologies as these much more less massive objects. okay? So the diskiness does appear to be much more predominant in these very extreme massive objects, but not at all in the lower mass objects. We can actually go and measure the sizes of these objects as well. That's something that in yellow here we show some observational results for, so based on those observations, and in blue is the simulation. Again, these are the faint objects which are comparable to current observations, and these are the predictions for the more massive objects. So massive disks in relatively bright galaxies are still sizes that are very, very compact compared to galaxies today. This is a kiloparsec scale, so that's very small. We can also look at how much rotational support there is in this galaxy. Are they really disks, basically, according to the way we think a disk is like in the Milky Way? So you can plot basically the velocity of the stars versus over the velocity of dispersion. So how much dynamical support do we have? A typical disk is above a value of 5, and so these are perhaps a bit turbulent, but real disks. And now moving beyond these disks, if I look at other galaxies in there, which could be also very massive, this is what I'm plotting here is the mass of the halo. So we have all this disky population here, sort of color-coded in these yellowish-red colors. I still have very massive galaxies that have these blue colors that indicate a very different morphology, that it's massive but not quite as disky. And what are these galaxies like? What they have in the y-axis, this shows the amount of gas that there is in these galaxies. So when we have this disk, we still have very high gas fractions at these high redshifts, but there's objects that are yet gas richer and they're not disky. So this sort of links back to my second question of what are the populations of quasars and black holes like then? Why? Because in these are kind of objects is where we find the most massive black holes. So the most massive black holes, the ones that have grown a lot, have not quite grown in these objects which have disks, but they have grown more in these very gas-rich objects. I'll show you a bit more in a second. So this is an example of the most massive black holes now at even earlier epoch. So these are things that we've yet to observe, but hopefully even in the with very upcoming data with the HSC and other the Japanese survey, and later on definitely with WFIRST, we should see. So black hole masses that even approach a few times 10 to the 8 at earlier epochs, black holes that are accreting very fast at this epoch. And so this is sort of the black hole mass compared to the stellar mass of the galaxy. So this is the example of the most extreme object at about 400 million years after the Big Bang, okay? The prediction is that the more absolute most massive objects are already a few times 10 to the 8 solar mass, but there's still other pre-massive black holes in massive galaxies. And some of the disk galaxies also have pre-massive black holes, but not the most extreme ones. And this was sort of what, where do these massive black holes live? This is the other example that I had in this blue plot of the blue tides originally. I have another region here, which goes under the blue water sign somewhere, I guess, where I'm zooming in as an example, an illustration of one of these regions where, in fact, actually where the most massive black hole has grown. Okay, so this is the density of the gas around it at fairly large scale, zooming in to smaller scale, and eventually the galaxy in there, which looks much more elliptical, much more spheroidal. The overall region compared to where the disks were forming, remember, was quite filamentary. It's very different. It's a region where collapses occur much more spherically. We haven't had the formation of these large-scale filaments, but the gas has been able to move into the central potential very, very fast. In fact, you can go and look at many of these regions, and they typically have these characteristics. They have these extremely a super compact high-density region in the very, very center where everything has collapsed to rather than more filamentary structures. So this is the gas that's still very large scale, but it still looks like the high-density, the brightest region is just one point this is still cosmological scales, okay, and then moving in, we see that in this central region, the gas is falling into more radio filaments, very thin, very collimated kind of filaments all the way to the very central region. And so sort of summarizing, there's a different scenario appearing for the formation of the very first massive galaxies, where they're associated with both massive galaxies and black holes to very high density regions, but of a sort of different nature, sort of illustrated in this plot. So where we expect this massive disk to form in this sort of over density dominated by sort of this collapse that is more along the filament, in these regions where we draw the most massive black hole, the collapse is much more radial. To be a bit more quantitative and sort of trying to attempt to relate this to even more fundamental physics in our initial condition of the universe, what we can measure is the actual tidal field, right? So we have all this matter and it's being pulled, and so just much like the moon and the earth, right? So what you end up relating with a formation of this to regions of very high tidal fields, whereas black holes can, you can induce very large recoil in a region of lower tidal field. Large tidal field will induce the formation of filaments, and in filaments, there's much more tangential motion than of little objects within filaments, which slows down the inflow of gas. In weak tidal fields, you leave filaments, the inflow in very thin filaments, you don't stretch them out into one large filament, but that induces a lot more radial motion and let the gas accrete cold and radially without spinning things up as much in the tangential direction. So this is what we're just looking into, just to give sort of a more fundamental picture of why are this region giving you these different answers for the one region, very high density, yet the black holes don't grow as much. Other regions, they grow tremendously. And again, relating it back to something that we can calculate even from the initial conditions, the initial tidal fields, so regions which will induce from our standard initial conditions these different scenarios. As I said, the fun stuff is that we can make predictions for these populations from this very large volume. So we take every galaxy, we can look at this full spectral energy distribution in different bands, to make detailed predictions, like take that, we have enough information to metallicity, stellar ages, and so on, to make simulated galaxies that will be observed for JWST, predictions that we should see at least four times as many galaxies than in current HST fields, so fun stuff coming along. We can take the simulation, make predictions for WFIRST. So this is the predictions of the cumulative number of galaxies, and we're going to be looking at finding galaxy all the way to redshift 13 and 14, so just maybe a couple of hundred years after the Big Bang, according to these predictions. And we're going to start probing populations of black holes at this very early epoch as well, with numbers that are going to be tens of thousands. So lots of excitement here. So the end of the Dark Ages is very bright. There's a lot that's going to be discovered in there. And we were really excited. Last month was just one result, very unexpected, very, very exciting from Hubble. They were able to push the limit of the highest redshift galaxies to redshift 11. So this is just 400 million years after the Big Bang, the absolute highest redshift record galaxy. It was thanks to using the GRISM spectrograph, so finding an actual very good identification. And we've been making these predictions of this bright population of galaxies should be out there. They say that, in fact, this galaxy was surprisingly bright. They didn't expect to see such bright galaxies. So we were really excited and got together with them. So this is plotted as in terms of it's one galaxy in their volume. This is a number density in their volume probe. And this is blue tides, the only prediction that is available to probe galaxies at that luminosity and in those kind of volumes. So we don't, maybe the future is already now, it's the present. It's already quite bright. And I'm very excited to keep working on this Very excited because we are able to really push. We have reached a level of sophistication in the physics, in the calculation, and the computational power is such that we can really get going with this now. We're just entering sort of the bright phase and the fun phase for this kind of science. So I'll stop at that.
I don't know if there are any questions. We probably have just one minute for questions. Sorry, that's okay. You started a little late, so maybe one there and one there quickly. What does this capability now, about telling us, given the cosmic acceleration and microwave background that you're looking at, what does this tell us about theoretical physics at this stage of our understanding?
You mean what dark matter or dark energy is?
What is it beginning to illuminate? Or what are the questions that we can now ask that we couldn't ask?
In terms of, we can ask the fundamental physics that we have. So what we can ask are the questions that, you know, if we are able to produce also models that have some amount of dark matter and dark energy, we can ask detailed questions of how do we probe the properties of the evolution of, for instance, of dark energy over cosmic history? What do we see in galaxies as properties of an evolving dark energy versus a non-evolving dark energy? What can we, so is dark energy constant in time or not? Yeah, so this is a, sort of the kind of question that we're going to be able to really tackle. We study the growth of structure, right? And we can study that in simulations, and I've given you the standard model for that, but I could change that, okay? The growth of structure tells you about, is it really dark energy or is it modified gravity? Okay, so that's another very, very interesting question. So that's not what I talked about today at all. I stuck to one model, this sort of what we call the standard lambda CDM, and I looked about, looked on galaxies and so on. And various other questions at that level, but you can study them directly by, you know, taking your observed galaxies and relate it directly to, like, the dark matter, for instance, or the dark energy that you have in a theoretical model, right, and bring them together.
Great. Very, very interesting. One question is, so you talked about, you know, you've increased the physics and you've increased the amount of physics in the models and you've increased the resolution as well.
Yeah.
So as you move forward, in particular, you mentioned that now you're including ionization.
Yeah.
And to me, as somebody who does plasma physics, ionization means you're going to have magnetic field.
Yeah.
And so how are you going to deal with that, or are you going to ignore it, or what?
Yeah. So good question. I've ignored it for now, and it's not a good idea to ignore it. And people have already signed magneto hydrodynamical calculation cosmologically. So you could do it on MHD cosmologically. You can't. Not at this level of resolution, and you know, because of the level, but you can start making including MHD. This is not included here.
That's going to substantially change your connectivity and your parallelism.
It depends how well you do it or how badly you do it. Then it depends really what are you interested in, magnetic fields at what scales, or are you just interested in how they affect the overall structure formation. No, they may not affect my parallelism. I'm interested in really what the physics really does on the scale, sub-galactic scales. Yeah, it's a little better, yeah. So infancy for that, you know, magnetic fields are very subdominant cosmologically, right? Very, very subdominant. So we're not screwing up too bad, but obviously you're right. More realism, more physics also will need that. Go there, yeah.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for attending today's presentation. This does conclude the call. You may disconnect at this time on the phone line.